This is Future Buzz.
That was Outer National's Future Rock, and that's the intro to the show today. And I'm Michael Slate. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. Now, I know people who've been listening to this for a while heard last week that I was going to rename the show Red Future Radio. Well, I'm still toying with that. I want to play with it a little bit more. I want to actually get a name that will concentrate sort of the vision and the concept of this show, and I'm just not all that comfortable with Red Future Radio right now, but I'm looking for another name. Until then, we're going to call it The Michael Slate Show. Now, if you have any suggestions about names, and you're welcome to mail them to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And I'd really appreciate any input you have on that. And the key thing here is thinking about what the concept of this show is and how the name should really concentrate that. And the concept is something that explores many, many avenues. Many avenues brings many voices to bear on the show, enters into a conversation with many different kinds of people about many different subjects with one aim, and that's to discover the truth, and to discover the truth in order to change the world. And I consider that very important in terms of not only being able to understand that we need a different world, but also that it's possible, and to help develop the vision that people need in order to make that come to reality. So think about that if you're thinking about a name. Until then, it's going to be The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. Today, I'm really happy to welcome my guest is Raymond Lotta. He's a revolutionary intellectual and one of the foremost experts in the world on the experience and history of socialism as it's existed in the world in the 20th century, particularly and especially in the Soviet Union and China, the socialist societies that were built there. Raymond has studied those societies, building off of the work that Bob Avakian has done. He studied those societies and studied why did they have to be upheld, what was overwhelmingly positive about them, as well as what was wrong. And he's countered the veritable tsunami that has swept over the reality of those experiences and filled our heads with all kinds of lies and distortions. And Raymond's been out there in the forefront of uncovering the truth. And he heads up a project called the Setting the Record Straight Project, which is dedicated to, in fact, countering all the lies and distortions. Raymond is also currently on a campus tour across the country. And the title of that tour is Everything You've Been Told About Communism is Wrong. Capitalism is a failure. Revolution is the solution. And I'm very happy, as I said, I'm very happy to welcome Raymond to the show today to discuss what that title's all about and the experience of socialist revolution and the kinds of the truth and the lies that have been put out there. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Michael, and I'm very honored to be part of the maiden voyage of your show, and I'm very happy to be interacting with your audience.
All right, well, let's jump into this. The title of this speech that you're giving this is really something that sort of jumps out at you. Everything you've been told about communism is wrong. You have this whole point about everything is a lie that you've been told about communism. What are you doing here? Why this? Why now?
Well, the title does say it all, but the title is a sort of a launching pad for what my speech is all about. And, you know, what I'm doing with this speech is taking on the dominant narrative, the master narrative, if you will, about communism and the experience of communist revolution in the 20th century. And that master narrative basically is this. Look, there are these attempts to create new societies that were free from exploitation and oppression. But this was just a hopeless utopian ideal that in power turned into a nightmare and just led to disaster and horror upon horror. And this is the master narrative because it's an account which is a false and factually distorted picture of what happened in these societies. And more importantly, and very much linked to this master narrative, is the message that you can't go beyond capitalism, that this system may have its problems, but this is the best of all possible worlds. And all you can do is kind of tinker around the edges, put some Band-Aids on it. But this is the only and the best game in town. And I'm really challenging this. Lock, stock, and barrel, both the prettification of capitalism, which many of your listeners are debating themselves, and very, very key to this whole thing is that there is an alternative. And this alternative is not just some abstract vision of wouldn't things be nice if we could do this or do that, but the alternative has actually shown its worth. That is, there was a first wave of socialist revolutions in the 20th century, first in the Soviet Union between 1917 and 1956, and then in China from 1949 to 76. And these revolutions, these socialist societies, were breakthroughs in human emancipation, breakthroughs. And the Cultural Revolution, in particular, was the most liberating episode in world history. People don't know this. Students don't know this. And there's a discourse in society that is filled with lies and distortions about communism. And this is what I'm challenging and taking on many different levels. There's both the speech that I'm giving, which goes into the history of these revolutions, and then there are open letters that I've issued to prominent scholars like Tony Jute, the historian of the 20th century and European political thought. He's based at NYU. I issued a challenge to him because he's the embodiment of a kind of a liberal anti-communist discourse, which is really highly entrenched in academia. I'm also, as you pointed out, uncovering a lot of these silly lies where Mao is routinely compared with Hitler as a mass murderer, where Mao and Stalin are described as people that were just bent on power for its own sake and ruthlessly ruling over societies, putting people away. And I'm actually sort of breaking down what happened in these revolutions. And I'm doing three things. What were these revolutions aiming to do? What did they actually accomplish? And where are their shortcomings and problems? And how can we do better in a new wave of revolution? And that's where I get into what Bob Avakian is bringing forward.
All right, well, let me ask you this, because it's true. I mean, especially since Michael Moore's film, I was telling you on the way over here, I remember driving down a street in Echo Park on the way to some other part of the city and looking out my window, sitting in a traffic jam, looking out the window, and there's two big giant posters, I mean, huge, like 5x5. And they say, capitalism, we've got a problem. And there's much more a questioning of capitalism and what the hell is going on here. People that wear T-shirts that have an expletive about capitalism, I've worn that T-shirt and I've had more people. I've had people in Trader Joe's give me a break on products because they say, yes, what a great shirt. But at the same time, in this country, and particularly among a very broad swath of people, you have at the very best, I mean, officially, Satan would get more airtime and more exposure than anyone who's advocating communism. I mean, why is that? And what do you think about that? On one hand, you have the idea that there's something very terribly wrong with capitalism, healthcare, all this other thing, all these things that people are seeing, you know, the wars, everything. At the same time, like you said, people are content with tinkering around the edges. But at the same time, communism is actually ruled out of order in terms of even talking about it. But then there's also the problem that a lot of people don't even think about it as a possibility.
Right. Well, I think this is part of the atmospheric that I'm trying to change through this tour and through many other dimensions and ways as well. In my speech, I first start by talking about how the mainstream scholarship, the state-of-the-art scholarship about the history of these revolutions is just strewn with lies and distortions. I talk about how, you know, there are the mainstream notions of what communism is and how all of these things are wrong. And then I go into what socialism and communism are. And in terms of what socialism is, socialism is a new form of political power in which the formerly exploited and oppressed, in alliance with the great majority of society, the middle classes and the professionals, in alliance with them, rule over society, in which the forces of exploitation and new forces of exploitation and counter-revolution are held in check. And this new form of political power, this new form of class rule, unleashes people, gives them the right and ability to change the world and to change themselves, and opens up whole new vistas of democracy, of dissent, of great, great transformation in society. So that's the first thing socialism is. It's a new form of political rule. Second, it's a new economic system based on social cooperation as opposed to private ownership and the quest for profit at the expense of human need. It's an economic system based on serving the needs of the people and advancing the revolution in that society and throughout the world. And third, socialism is a transition. It's a revolutionary period of great change and struggle to bring about communism, which is the ending of this division of society into classes, a world community of humanity in which people are working in common for the common good. So this is what socialism and communism are. People don't know those basic facts. And then they're told all of these distortions about what actually happened in the revolutionary years of the Soviet Union and China.
They're given alternative views to alternative models. You know, there's a number of places out there that people say, this is the model to shoot for. This is the aim. And the idea that there has to be a resting spot in the 21st century because we can't go any further given the way forces are lined up in the world. And so the best you can do is Hugo Chavez or Cuba or something along those lines. Or at one point it was the Zapatistas, although even though the Zapatistas said, we're really not about any kind of state power or really fundamental changing the entire society except through people changing people's minds, having people have discussions. Now, but there's all these models that come out that are somewhat short of one dealing with what is the real problem and what's the solution. And I think it's something that works in concert with this whole the downpressing of the genuine history. To me, why would people go any further if their whole sense of socialism has been good idea but really horrible in its workings?
Yeah, well, look, I think what you just said encapsulates that master narrative. You know, it may be a good idea, but it's a disaster in practice. And this is what I get into in my talk. I actually talk about, we discuss, for instance, in writings that I've done in connection with this talk, the Soviet Union. One of the things we've done with this tour is we hand out a pop quiz to students because we say we really got to get a big debate going on the campuses, because if there isn't a searching for the truth and people really entertaining alternatives to the system on the campuses, that is among the students, the new generation, and if professors are repeating these lies, this is putting a tremendous halter and constraint on critical thinking and the kind of discourse and conversation that's needed urgently today about alternatives to the system. Well, anyway, we put out this pop quiz, and it has some basic and very elementary facts about the experience of socialist revolution in the 20th century. For instance, one of the questions is, what was the only country in Eastern and Central Europe in the 1930s that was combating anti-Semitism as a matter of policy and official stand and actual practice? Well, the only country that was doing so, the answer to that question, is the Soviet Union. And this was under Stalin's leadership. People don't know that, but this is the truth. And you can examine that history, and I'm bringing that history forward. Or we give another question. What was the only country in the 1960s whose leadership called on people to rise up against oppressive authority and political and social structures? The answer was Mao, China, the Cultural Revolution. That was what was going on in China. These basic facts have been hidden from view. People need to know this. They need to talk about what I've been discussing about what socialism is actually and what it's not. Now, you talked about these other models, these other ideas, Cuba, the Chavez Road, etc. Now, I think it's very important to understand that when we're talking about socialist revolution, and I talked about the three dimensions of it as a form of political class rule, a new political power that's aiming to unleash, you know, the masses of people to remake society and themselves, their thinking, consciously and voluntarily. But you have institutions and structures that's encouraging this and that's giving direction to this, and the leadership of a vanguard communist party that's enabling this revolution to both stay in power and to move forward. Now, you have this kind of political structure. You have the economic transformations. And as I said, you have a vision of moving forward to a whole new world without exploitation and oppression. Now, in these cases, what I'm talking about is a total revolution. In other words, one of the things we have to understand, and your listeners have to understand, is that socialism is not state ownership. It's not government control of some enterprises or industries. It's not bailing out General Motors. That's capitalism. That's the capitalist state bailing out failing capitalist enterprise. Regulations are not socialism. Socialism is what I'm talking about. Nor is socialism a welfare state in which you just have more goods that are being circulated in society or a redistribution of income.
Why
it's
not
a total revolution?
Why not? Because that has been, I mean, look, I remember the years that I spent writing about Africa and traveling to Africa and other countries and a lot of places in the third world, for the middle classes that in these liberation movements, for instance, the idea that was presented to people was socialism occurs at the point of distribution. Mm-hmm. There's a leveling out, supposedly, of society in distribution mm-hmm. terms. And we'll talk about leveling out in other terms later. But in the argument often comes out is all we have to do is level things out. Or what Walter Rodney said. Walter Rodney said that how Europe underdeveloped Africa. And then they went from there. They took a basic point of exposure he was making and then turned it into a strategy of playing catch up, mm-hmm. that the idea was to then develop Africa. There are these things that get pushed out there that frankly, you do have to make a break with capitalism in every sphere, even in terms of your thinking, to actually understand that this is not just what socialism mm-hmm. is, but it's also not just a pipe dream. You're not on the pipe in terms of arguing this stuff out. There's something real here, but it's going up against all these different arguments.
Right. Well, look, I think we were talking about these misconceptions of socialism. Look, there are three alternatives. Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, I think has very sharply described the three alternatives in the world. I mean, one, we could leave the world the way it is, which is not acceptable. I mean, we're talking about 1 billion people that are going without food, that are hungry, and many of them facing starvation or near starvation conditions. We're talking about all these wars. We're talking about the sex trade in women. This is the nature of the system. We're talking about intellectual property rights that makes an AIDS vaccine a matter of profitable investment and distribution. This is not the world that humanity needs, and it's not the world that we have to live in. Now, we have these three alternatives. One is to leave that world the way it is. The second is to kind of modify things, but to leave the basic power relations and the basic economic relations and the basic class divisions intact. In other words, nothing's going to fundamentally change, but now there'll be more distribution of some social goods, some slight improvement in education to those on the bottom of society, or you'll have some kind of political system where there isn't a fundamental change in these relations, but where people claiming to be the spokespeople for those on the bottom of society are running things, as Hugo Chavez is doing in Venezuela. But that's not a society that's in any way making what I call a twofold break. Okay, what do I mean? It's not making a break with imperialism, that is the domination of that economy and that society by the world economic system that we live under, dominated by the large imperial powers and by the whole system of exploitation. In Venezuela, you still have an oil industry that's geared to producing for the world market. And that whole society is governed by the dictates of oil production. So that Venezuela, for instance, imports about 70% of its food requirements. It's just remarkable. This is not a society that's actually freeing itself from the clutches of imperialism and world domination and all of those exploitative relations. So it hasn't made that break, nor has it made another break, and that is a break with all the old relations of exploitation, all the old political relations whereby a small class is dominating political and social life, nor is it making the break with the old ways in which people interact and interrelate with each other, for instance, around the oppression of women. I mean, Venezuela is still, it's just very cruel and obscene. It's a center of beauty industry in the world. And Chavez has described himself as someone who's opposed to abortion and is sort of a socialist Catholic. He's all over the place. This is not a society guided by a vision of turning the whole world and all of society upside down. It's a society where you have a redistribution of some wealth, but you have tremendous concentration of poverty in the equivalent of the barrios, the slums of Caracas, because they haven't carried out any kind of thoroughgoing economic revolution that is breaking up the power of the landed oligarchy. These are all examples on the economic level, on the cultural level, question of women. These are all examples of a revolution which hasn't ruptured with the old ways of thinking and the old ways in which people are interrelating with each other. And then the third alternative I've talked about, leave the world the way it is or make these kinds of modifications around the edges that don't fundamentally change the relations in society and the world. And the third alternative is a real revolution, a total revolution in all the realms that I'm describing. One of the things that Mao was so insistent upon is that a revolution, if you want to talk about it in time and space, maybe on two dimensions, a revolution has to be in space. A revolution has to involve all the relations of society, not just the economy, not just politics, but culture, ways of thinking, challenging the old habits and customs, whether we're talking about the influence of Confucian values in which those who don't have an education have to submit to those with greater knowledge, in which women have to submit to men, in which those who live in the cities are considered superior. These kinds of things that Mao, all these habits and customs, That revolution is a total revolution. So Mao is saying that the revolution has to transform all spheres of society. And he's also saying, if you want to talk about it in terms of time as well as space, that the revolution has to continue. Mao, you know, discovered that you're going to need to make new revolutions under socialism because there will be the emergence of new privileged forces within society. So this is a very exciting vision. And Avakian has taken this third model that I'm talking about, not leaving things the way they are, not a social welfare state, but a total revolution. Avakian has taken this model to a whole new place of understanding about how to create an even more vibrant and an even more liberating socialist society that truly empowers people to remake institutions and to transform their thinking and values.
I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Raymond Latta. Raymond's one of the foremost experts in the world on the experience of socialism in the 20th century, especially in the Soviet Union and China. And he's currently on tour across the country, a campus tour titled Everything You've Been Told About Communism is Wrong. Capitalism is a failure. Revolution is the solution. And if you're interested in bringing Raymond to your campus, simply write him at lottaonyourcampus@yahoo.com. Again, that's Lotta, L-O-T-T-A, onyourcampus@yahoo.com. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. Today we're talking with Raymond Latta, revolutionary intellectual, about the history and experience of socialist societies in the 20th century, the Soviet Union and China, and talking about the truth. What is the real truth and why it's important to know that? Now, Raymond, here's the thing that people ask you all the time. They say this. If this is all true, you know, why does there appear to be so much, basically, people aren't like up in arms metaphorically even, about these societies no longer existing. And I was telling you, I went to the opening of the Chinese American Film Festival last night, and there was a film there that was called Turning Point 1977. And the kicker for the film said this: there was a moment in Chinese history that changed the lives and fate of 1 billion people. And that moment was when Deng Xiaoping signed an order that said students, there will be college entrance exams, and students will be allowed to take those exams if they want to take them, and people will be allowed back into college based solely on merit. And the whole thing was a big assault around the sending of all the Chinese students going to the countryside and the lives that they lived there. And I mean, it was just insane. I mean, if you could see it, it was sort of, these students were just like desperate to get out of the countryside. We've spent 10 years. They were living in really the equivalent of like those old pictures you saw of Eastern Europe, of, you know, cinder block and wood houses and snowstorms. And they're, you know, they just go out and they, you know, plow the rocky earth. They do all this other stuff, and they're doing their work, but they view it as having been sent to the gulags for 11 years. And they will never get out. They have no future. They have no hope. They will never get out. And there's one scene where they're rushing to get the train to take them to the exam center. And it was like one of those things from one of those 1940s movies or something. One of these movies where the Jewish prisoners who have escaped the concentration camps are running through the woods, desperately chasing after the train to jump on it and get their liberation and freedom. And they're showing all these students, and that's what's conjured up in your mind. And it's really, they made a point that actually at that point, when the exams were allowed, 11.8 million young people took those exams. 675,000 went on to go to college, and they form basically the leaders of science, culture, the economy, industry, all this stuff, in political leaders in the country today. And so I'm sitting there with this whole crowd of people who are in tears about the plight of the poor students, you know? And I think this is a very common conception people have of what socialism, for all its grandiose ideas, means on the ground for people.
Well, it's a common conception, you say. It's actually a common misconception. And it's a deliberately fostered perception of the experience of the Chinese Revolution that's used, as I said, to put blinders on people. And, you know, I do want to say, I mean, it's you know, we're dealing in a situation. I was reading a letter by Sansara Taylor, whom you've had on the show, and she's been someone who's been out there taking up the same, you know, this speaking tour that I'm on. You know, everything you've been told about communism is wrong, and she's been having lots of discussions with students. And she made this observation, which I think is really very apt. And she said, it's as though the young generation today is fighting and dreaming with their hands tied behind their backs. That's the product of these misconceptions and distortions and lies that are told about communism. Because people do yearn for something better and different. And then immediately they're smacked in the face with these horror stories of revolutions gone, you know, gone amok, and all the disaster and horror and debacle that's supposed to follow in their wake. And the story that you're telling about what happened in education in China during the Cultural Revolution is another sort of illustration of it. And maybe we can deconstruct that a little bit so that, sure, you know, your listeners can get a better feel for what I'm doing in my talk and what the stakes are of this. And
absolutely.
Also, I think it's curious because you asked me, well, these revolutions were reversed, and how do you explain that? And here you're telling me about Deng Xiaoping. So it's sort of ironic, you're giving me the example that's really a sort of a little feed into what to something that really helps us understand why these revolutions were reversed. Because this film, which I haven't gotten to see, I fully intend to see it perhaps during my visit here to Los Angeles, is describing Deng Xiaoping, who comes to power and then begins to implement a whole different series of social and economic policies. But that was all based, what Deng Xiaoping was doing was all based on the seizure of power by a section of the Communist Party that had tremendous strength, you know, these bourgeois capitalist rotors, as Mao described them, who had tremendous strength and influence in the structures of the party and the government, and who carried out a coup. It was a reactionary coup in 1976. This was right after Mao died. And they arrested literally hundreds of thousands, executed thousands, and began to impose a whole new social and economic system that is the return to the old. And you ask, why is it that this revolution was reversed in China? Well, because there were people like Deng Xiaoping that were organizing against it and who, truth be told, did have influence among sections of the population. This is the nature of socialist society. One, these societies exist in a world that's still dominated by imperialism, and the imperialists, they don't say to the revolution power, look, great, go try your new social experiment. We'll leave you alone. Come back in 20 years and let's compare notes. No, the imperialists, they try to crush them in the cradle right from the outset. That's what happened in the Soviet Union right after the revolution and throughout its history. That's what happened in China, the pressures that were put on China. And that's the one side, the imperialist. And then within these societies, you have forces like Deng Xiaoping, who claimed to be communist, but were actually organizing around a whole different program opposed to that revolution and wanting to reinstitute the old. Now, let's look at this example of education, because I think it's a very good illustration of what was going on. You know, it's often charged that Mao was anti-education and anti-intellectual. And that's what this film is telling you. And it's saying that people were denied the right to an education. Okay, let's look at the reality. One, a fact. Secondary middle school enrollment in China between 1966 and 1976, the years of the Cultural Revolution, middle school enrollment rose from 15 million to 60 million. That's a fourfold increase. Most of that increase was accounted for by the expansion of educational opportunity in the countryside. So you have people going to school, children of peasants going to school, who never had a chance to do that before. This was a concrete product of the Cultural Revolution that began to shift resources and to put priorities on the educational and social needs of those who constitute the majority of society, the 80% of the population that lived in the countryside. It was an incredible improvement of the quality of life of those people. Second, was Mao anti-education? Well, by this fact that I'm giving you, it's very clear that there wasn't just a sort of a complete obliteration of educational institutions and instruction. No. What happened was there was a transformation of the educational system. Mao was against elitism in education. You had a school system before the Cultural Revolution, which was not that different from the kind of experiences we've seen in a class-divided society like our own, where you had the sons and daughters of the elites and the more privileged privileged, who had access to the best schools, and you had people from the workers and peasants who were basically locked out. And the Cultural Revolution, if you will, created an affirmative action program on a scale unseen in human history in terms of opening up education in the universities. For instance, through the Cultural Revolution, the majority of the enrollment of the universities became workers and peasants. But that was only part of it. They also changed the curriculum in terms of what was being studied. They struggled over the relations between professors and students. The old system in China before the Cultural Revolution was one in which the university professors had this unquestioned authority. Nobody questions the professor. This kind of attitude, these relations stemming from the old society and the old ways, were challenged. You also had a situation where education was no longer seen as just a narrow experience of what's in the classroom. People went into the surrounding neighborhoods, into factories, into the countryside. And one of the great innovations of the Cultural Revolution was to send, first of all, the young people were catalysts for the Cultural Revolution, students and others. You know, they were part of the Red Guard movement that began to rise up against oppressive authority and to help workers and students to sort of open their eyes up to what was going on in society and how it was that a new privileged elite was beginning to amass power. Students went to the countryside to learn from peasants. Doctors and professionals went to the countryside to share skills and to learn from the peasants. You had a vast expansion of healthcare in the countryside. Now, was this what I'm describing, you know, punishment to intellectuals and to professionals? No, this was all part of a process of a twofold process. One, breaking down the historic lopsidedness in Chinese society where resources, education, health, culture as well were concentrated in the cities. So it was part of breaking down that lopsidedness so that these resources, this knowledge, these skills were being spread throughout society. And second, it was part of an attempt to break down the gaps and the divisions between the more educated and those on the bottom of society, the peasants and workers. And now doctors and others were going to the countryside. Students were going to the countryside to share their knowledge with peasants and also to learn from them. This is what was going on. So 10 million students, young people, went to the countryside. Many of them became barefoot doctors. That is, became part of a cadre of paramedics who were helping to provide basic health services in the countryside. These are the kinds of things that were going on in the coast. It's a very different picture, and it's a truthful one because you can read wonderful books, one of them called Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up in the Mao Era, that describe everything that I'm talking about at the grassroots level.
I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Raymond Latta, one of the world's foremost experts on the experience of socialism as it's unfolded in human history, and that's in the 20th century in the Soviet Union and China. And we're talking about not only the lies and distortions that have been told about these societies in order to cover up what they were really about, but also what the truth is. And breaking through and getting that truth and spreading that truth is a critical element of being able to really achieve the liberation of humanity. So we're going to, you think about that for a few seconds, and we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be rejoining our discussion with Raymond Latta. Welcome back. That's the OJs with Give the People What They Want. And that's sort of what we're talking about today. Not so much giving the people what they want, but giving people the vision that they need in order to achieve the kind of liberation that humanity needs. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. And today we're talking with Raymond Latta, a revolutionary intellectual who specializes in the history, the true history of socialist societies in China and in the Soviet Union. breaking through the smears that have been told about them and bringing out and spreading the truth in the face of those lies and actually helping people to understand why it's important that this truth is known. Raymond, I want to ask you this. It's really interesting because part of this thing of what happens in the, when you talk about the idea that socialism is, it unleashes all this, you know, all these good things for the people. But there's a question, and I think this happens a lot of people, part of the grayness that's always presented about socialist society is not just the idea that there's not enough material goods, but that actually there's no room for the human spirit to develop to its fullest extent. You know, the idea that people can be literally marched off to the, you know, how many times have I heard this phrase when I'm talking with people about socialism? It's like, yeah, well, if I was there, I'd be marched off to the gulag. You know, and it's sort of, and these are people who have no trouble marching off others to the gulag. But there are a lot of well-intended people look at it as, yeah, but you have to have this official ideology. There's a box in which you can think. And if you think outside the box, you have big problems. You know, people have to be, you know, deceit and underhandedness. And there's even, I'm reading a book now about somebody who's writing about Paradise Built in Hell is the name of the book. And it's a very good book. It's about how human relations are different in times of crisis, in times of disaster. And she's examining how humans step outside with each other. They actually step outside the norm. And mainly the contradiction shifts from being between people to actually being between the authorities and the people, because the authorities have a whole different view of how to handle disasters. But there's a whole scene, there's a whole point that even there, this kind of de rigueur denunciation of socialism and communism, where she talks about this, the beautiful community that developed in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union about people who became a community of trying to resolve the question of want, and not just physical want in terms of the needs, what we need to stay alive, but actually spiritual and cultural want, the human dignity question, the dignity encompassing everything that humans are about. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to be said. I think you're referring to
Rebecca Solnit.
Solnit's book, yeah, which is interesting because if you look at something like Hurricane Katrina in the United States, you know, a few years back, you had all kinds of people, you know, nurses, you know, relief workers, you had doctors, you had all kinds of people, meteorologists, engineers, all sorts of people that wanted to go down to New Orleans to help people in that disaster. And yet they were prevented from doing so by the very nature of this society. That is, this is not a society that's organized to mobilize people around the greater interests of society and humanity. And when there was a disaster like this, the first responders were the National Guard and the police, if you will, to impose a rule of hell on people that were suffering under those conditions. But all these people in society, teachers, all kinds of people, bus drivers, medical workers, all these people were prevented from going down there to really be part of a common effort to deal with that awful problem. And it was the youth, the black youth, who had to go out, who were sort of on the one hand facing guns and on the other hand the horrific conditions, and people going out and getting water and rescuing people. This is not what this society can do. And in a socialist society, this gets turned around. You're actually organizing a society around, one, meeting people's most basic needs and transforming that society so that you can build new structures and new relations on a cooperative foundation. And you are promoting new values, you know, values of people working for the common good, of putting the interests of the greater social interest first. Now, herein lies the rub, and this is what you're getting at in your question. In other words, one, what about this issue of the non-material in life? And I think this is very important. People, questions of meaning, a higher purpose. These are things that are part of what it means to be human. And in a socialist society, you are not simply eating. That's not the point, or having clothing. I don't want to live in a society in which that's taken care of for you by someone else and now just go back to work or just go back to your routine of life. No, I mean, social society has to be a place where people are exploring all kinds of dimensions of social life, where people are engaging not just in production, but in art, and people are taking responsibility for the direction of society, in which people are taking up scientific questions. This is part of Avakian's vision, very central to Bob Avakian's vision of what a socialist society is all about, where you are sort of overcoming all the old divisions, where only some people could engage in the realm of the arts, or some people could engage in the realm of working with ideas. You want to break those distinctions down. You want to create a society where you're actually developing an all-around individuality, And let's make a distinction between individuality and individualism. Individuality is a richness of development of individual expression and expressiveness, if you will, in which people are finding meaning through different activities that are important to them in the context of a society that's organized around social cooperation. Now, in previous socialist societies, there were great breakthroughs in solving the most pressing material needs that were confronting society. And you did in the case of China, for instance, in the Cultural Revolution, this idea of a gray, drab society. That's the furthest thing from the truth of what was the Cultural Revolution, because you had incredible debate taking place, debate over, you know, what level, you know, leaders in the educational institutions, what they were doing and not doing, what policies they were advocating. In Beijing alone, you had 900 newspapers that were circulating in the first year of the culture. You know, all this extraordinary back and forth. You had protests, you had mass meetings, assemblies in which every level of authority was being called out on the carpet for their being removed and distant from the people, questions of accountability. And you did have the experience of people going to the countryside, learning from other sections of the population. But, you know, what Avakian is saying is that we do have to do better in terms of creating a society in which you have certain priorities and focuses, you have a main direction in society in which you need to stand up to imperialism. You need to address, for instance, in this society, in the United States, when a revolution comes to power, we're going to have to deal with the legacy of racism, the oppression of women, environmental issues. It's going to be very central questions in any socialist society that we build here. On the other hand, while you will have those focuses, you know, we got to put resources, we have to get lots of people sort of involved in solving those problems, you know, whether it's rebuilding housing in the former ghettos and the barrios, expanding educational opportunity, dealing with health issues. And while you have to have those focuses, you also have to have the ability of people to go off into other directions and pursue what they think is important in their lives with others and on their own. You have to have that combination of a focus in society, focuses, if you will, but then also diversity and a lot of creativeness within those social frameworks. Now, Avakian is saying we have to learn from the advances of this first wave of socialist revolution, but also see that there are problems. And one of the problems was that there was a certain tendency to say that while we have these focuses, you know, everything has to be sort of geared to those focuses, as opposed to, yes, you need those focuses, but on that basis, you need to have all kinds of diversity of expression and people going off and pursuing all kinds of interests.
Let me ask you this, because it leads right up into the, and we just had a caller who called in and asked about the Cultural Revolution, and he said, so many historians are saying that millions were killed during the Cultural Revolution. Who were they, and why were they killed? And thinking about that in relation to also another aspect of that question, there is still a big part of human dignity and humanity. What it is that makes you human is actually, and even in terms of your interaction with the world, is people sum things up differently. They synthesize things differently in whatever way. They understand. Some people see something that others don't. And it's in this quest for truth that there's a truth to change the world. There has to be, and this is one thing that I know Avakian has done a lot of work on, but this idea of dissent. And this has been a huge, huge, huge question. And the dissent in every realm, political dissent, there's also been, look, there has been a clamping. I mean, this is part of what you're talking about, the problem. I remember being astounded. And when I interviewed Bob Avakian, we talked about this, the idea that jazz and rock were banned in China, or that there was a clampdown on the arts movement in the Soviet Union to a certain extent, you know, under Stalin. Some of it has to do with what you're talking about, but there's a certain thing about a misconception, or perhaps sensing some of the things that were actually wrong, some of the problems, but this idea of dissent, the importance of dissent, and then this question of historically, like this listener called in and asked, he or she thinks millions were killed in the Cultural Revolution, and who were they and why were they killed?
Hmm. Well, let's first start with this question about the deaths during the Cultural Revolution. No, this is just not true. First of all, there's no reliable data to begin with. I mean, I do a lot of study this, talk with scholars of many different persuasions and bents, and have surveyed quite a bit of the literature on this. First of all, there's no reliable data on the numbers of people that were killed during the Cultural Revolution. Millions? No, absolutely not. This is just a completely erroneous idea. These numbers have just been thrown out by all kinds of reactionary scholars and by liberal and even progressive thinkers who just uncritically and unthinkingly accept these charges. It's just not true. And your listener can go to the website thisiscommunism.org, and they can look at some of the literature, some of the articles I've written and others dealing with these charges. The Cultural Revolution was carried out under a certain framework, within a certain framework. And it was a revolution that was carried out not through violent means principally, not, and it didn't involve purges and executions and death camps. This was not what the Cultural Revolution was about or grounded in. It was mass debate. It was mass political struggle. It was mass political mobilization. It was mass criticism. And the deaths that took place during the Cultural Revolution were the result of many complex factors. There were people who were genuinely inspired by the ideals that got carried away. And when that happened, when there were deaths and there was violence, Mao and the revolutionary leadership called that out and criticized it and reined it in. It's very important for listeners to understand that Mao was leading that cultural revolution from a certain standpoint, which is that this great debate and the great struggle that was taking place to challenge these capitalist rulers, to overthrow them and to revolutionize all the institutions of society and to forge new values, this was all done, this was done overwhelmingly through political and ideological means. So one, where there were excesses committed by the revolutionaries, these things were criticized. Two, not all the excesses, not all the deaths and the killings that took place were done by revolutionaries. In fact, the capitalist roaders also resorted and very importantly organized counter-revolutionary violence and fanned all kinds of attacks on people and murderous episodes in order to discredit the Cultural Revolution and to deflect attention away from them to others. And then there were, in any great revolutionary upheaval, you're going to have people that get caught up in this and resort to excess. And then within it, you're also going to have people, for instance, in the countryside during the Cultural Revolution that were settling grievances, long-standing scores and grievances, you know, under the pretext of the Cultural Revolution and were taking things out on each other. These are things that happen in any great upheaval, any great revolution. And the question is, what is the orientation? And Mao's orientation was that this was not a purge, not an extermination, not about killing fields, but it was about empowering people to stand up against these capitalist rulers and to transform the institutions of society. So this is in response to your caller. So that's the first point. These charges are just not true. And by the way, in China today, one of the things I used to hear was all the people that committed suicide during the Cultural Revolution. And these things, yes, some people did commit suicide. This happens, you know, and it did happen. But do you know that today in China there are 250,000 suicides a year in which people kill themselves? 250,000. And many of these take place in the countryside and involve young women who have no future in their lives because China today is not the kind of society that I was describing. It's a capitalist society. It's a society in which, by some estimates, there are 20 million sex workers, in which you have 150 million migrant workers roaming from the countryside to the cities and who become preyed upon and who find themselves having to work in these sweatshops that are run by internet. So this is the China of today. So I just want to be very, you know, sort of look at these things very, very clearly, the actual evidence, the actual reality of what Mao was trying to do. And these are lies that are told about the Cultural Revolution. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say in terms of the response to that.
I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Raymond Latta. Raymond's one of the foremost experts in the world on the experience of socialism in the 20th century, especially in the Soviet Union and China. And he's currently on tour across the country, a campus tour, titled, Everything You've Been Told About Communism is Wrong. Capitalism is a Failure. Revolution is the Solution. We're going to take a short break and be right back. Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate. And today we're talking with Raymond Latta, revolutionary intellectual, about the experience history of the socialist societies that have existed in the Soviet Union and China, why they were so important, and why it's important to understand the truth and to discard, to break through the lies that have been used to distort and cover up that history of those societies. So let's get into dissent now, because this is still a very critical question, and you know, and I think it's one that comes up all the time. And it's related to the thing about the grayness of society, the grayness of life.
Right. Well, I think that here you see the need to learn from the positive of the past experience, but to go further and in many respects to go beyond it. And this is what Avakian has been doing in his, you know, summation of the experience of the revolutions of the 20th century. In China during the Cultural Revolution, there was I gave these examples, just extraordinary debate. You know, in the, I talked about the 900 newspapers in Beijing. In Shanghai, at a certain point during the struggle of the Cultural Revolution there, there were 700 organizations of workers in factories. Such was the debate, such was the political intensity and the political passions you talked before about people being able to express their views. But this is what was going on during the Cultural Revolution in Shanghai. There were mass meetings involving literally tens of thousands of people. This was an extraordinarily aroused and awakened population.
There's the political involvement of people, but what about things like, for instance, what if some of those people wanted to form a jazz band? Or yeah. There's actually, I uncovered a rendition of the Internationale that was this Chinese rock band, Tang Dynasty.
Right, right, right.
And it is, I love it. It's really incredible. Right, and I try to play it every May Day or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And what those groups could not have existed at that time.
Right, right. Now, here we get to some of the shortcomings of the Cultural Revolution. And, you know, one of the things that I'm doing in this speech is I'm bringing forward the actual truth of these revolutions, what they set out to do, what they actually set out to do, what they accomplished, and where they fell short. And the experience of this is overwhelmingly positive, liberating, emancipating. On the other hand, I'm not shirking, the need to actually confront their weaknesses. And here we see some of the problems. For instance, let's take culture, what you're describing. On the one hand, the charge that this was a dry, drab, gray, or let's say a monochromatic, to take one word, kind of a monochromatic, is just so untrue. There was an incredible outpouring of artistic activity among basic and ordinary people, short story writing, peasant paintings. The revolutionary operas, the great revolutionary, what were called model works, were incredible breakthroughs, both artistically and in terms of content, putting women front and center on stage. Contemporary themes, the old mummies, as Mao said, the old mummies and emperors of the feudal court operas. These things were transformed. And these model operas and these model works that we're talking about were taken into the countryside. People put them on local peasant associations and troops, put them on in local dialects. They modified and shortened some of the scripts so they could keep the audience and did amazing things. And this contributed to this growth of literacy. And not only that, it contributed to people breaking down the old sort of parochialism between one village and another, the clan orientation of my little grouping. But this was being burst wide open through these cultural phenomena. On the other hand, while there was great breakthroughs in revolutionary culture, you did have limits that were placed on the old professional artists and intellectuals. And this was a real problem because it gets back to my point about a main focus. There was a very important focus on developing new revolutionary art, but then there were constraints and serious restraints that were put on artists who were not involved in creating these new revolutionary art forms, from artists who in the years previous to the Cultural Revolution were part of the academies in Beijing, the artistic academies, the Writers Association. These writers and artists, many of them went to the countryside and were learning from, this was one of the policies of the Cultural Revolution, for artists to interrogate their art from the standpoint of how is it contributing to the transformation of society? How much have they really learned from the experiences of people like peasants and workers? But there was a real problem here. And this is what, you know, you're sort of putting your finger on. And that is that there wasn't the space and the room for these artists and for these intellectuals to pursue their work in the framework of the Cultural Revolution. And instead, there was this kind of main force and main direction of that revolution consuming everything. And very, very importantly, this meant that these artists could not do the kind of work that they were doing before. And this robs society of something very important. It's not just a question of, will these artists be able to do these things? But you're robbing society of something very important, and that is the richness of cultural and intellectual life. And this gets back to your point about dissent, that you need dissent in socialist society. And one of the problems historically of, not only do you need it, but it is absolutely vital and essential to a socialist society and being the kind of society that people would want to live in that is going to go forward towards a world without classes and explanation. So this is something that Avakian has been emphasizing. You need to open up all these channels of dissent to provide resources and avenues through which people can express different political viewpoints, including opposition to socialism itself. This is an important breakthrough in understanding. During the Cultural Revolution, there was all this wide open debate, but it was still limited around the questions that were being thrown up by the Cultural Revolution. We have to open it up beyond that.
Okay, that about wraps it up for today. I want to remind listeners again that we've been talking with Raymond Lada, a revolutionary intellectual who specializes in the history of socialist societies and the experience of socialist societies as they've existed in the world so far, those societies being in the Soviet Union and China in the 20th century. And he talks about, he's basically talking about the real experience, breaking through the lies and distortion and the smears that have been spread about the nature of those societies and what the genuine nature of them was and why they were such an advance for human history and why it's important that we understand that. It has everything to do with the kind of vision of what we think is possible, what we think is necessary, and what we think is actually possible. That's the point. That's the point of it all, is understanding what's possible. Without this kind of understanding, our vision will never be able to rise to truly to the heights that we need to have it rise to. And let me remind listeners, if you're just tuning in or you've tuned in or you haven't heard this show before, or even for people who have heard it, this is Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show for the time being. Maybe we'll keep that name. Maybe we'll develop a different name. But for the time being, it's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And if you want to bring Raymond Lada to your campus, okay, if you want to bring him to your campus for this tour, write to him at ladaonyourcampus@yahoo.com. Again, that's Lada, L-O-T-T-A, onyourcampus@yahoo.com. And we're going to close out now. We're going to close out with a song that I've really come to love from the Funkadelics, which is Wake Up. All right. And it's kind of a great song. And it's a fitting end to this show. And again, you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know if you have any ideas for what we should name the show. You know, if you missed it in the beginning, we're searching for a name that will concentrate what we're all about. So without any further ado, let's get into Wake Up.